Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air. This week, we listen to your voicemails. Now, let's join Dan to discuss this week's episodes, Padawan Lost and Wookiee Hunt.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Republic Forces Radio Network, discussing all things Clone Wars. And we are here tonight to discuss the season finale of Season 3, Secrets Revealed, or not so much in this case. The episodes in question being Padawan Lost and Wookiee Hunt. And I am joined by Jerry.
Hey, guys.
Berent.
Hey, everybody. Here, Lizard. Come and find me.
And Nathan B. Butler.
Hello, my fellow whelps.
Let's start out with everybody's first impressions of... Go ahead with both episodes. What were your impressions of the episodes? Barrett, why don't you kick us off?
Okay.
My first impressions of both episodes were great. I mean, we got characters on both sides, the good and evil sides, that were very distinct, that were new, that you either liked or disliked right off the bat, so you had some sort of emotion that invested into it. So I thought first impressions were, I mean, these were two great episodes, and I can't wait until we get into the meat of them.
All right, Jerry?
Yeah, I really enjoyed these two episodes. I mean, I've gotten to the point where I do not expect a true finale out of the Clone Wars. I mean, there was nothing about these shows that were like, let's end the season with this, other than, hey, it's Chewbacca, and that's really big news. I mean, I kind of wish they would do more of that, hey, here's a cliffhanger, and, you know, really ties into episode one of season four. But, you know, okay, we didn't get that. So there's really nothing like major wow about this being a season finale, other than it's just literally the last show of the season. But that aside, I thought the shows were cool. I mean, I liked how things were depicted. I kind of liked the struggle that Ahsoka was in. I don't know how you guys feel about this. Maybe we'll talk about it later. But I've totally accepted Ahsoka as one of the key Jedi from this show. To me, it'd been no different if it was a, you know, she is far less of a random Jedi now to me than a Kit Fisto, Plo Koon, Sacy Tien is. Now, she's like a B-level Jedi now. And so revolving a couple episodes around something that she's involved in, I'm cool with now. I've accepted that three seasons later. So I thought it was a lot of fun. Great show.
All right. And Nathan.
You're going to have to disagree with Barrett here. No, I'm kidding. I'll just wait for later in the episode for that. I agree with actually both Barrett and Jerry. This was a great pair of episodes. I think Jerry is right on the money when he says that this was not really an episode or a pair of episodes that felt like a season finale. Then again, neither was Hostage Crisis, really. So in a sense, we haven't, as he said, ever gotten something that really felt like a season finale, except maybe season two. And even then, it only felt like a finale because it was a buildup of three episodes. In this case, what we wind up with is two really solid episodes, which I found very little to find fault with. There were a couple of things that were nitpicky to me, but my notes are mostly, wow, that was cool, wow, that was cool, as opposed to, well, what about this? Or even stupid little jokes to make. So that speaks kind of highly of these episodes. Though I will say it does have one moment that makes it feel like a season finale, and that is the last minute or so, just in that little exchange between Anakin and Ahsoka, and particularly Yoda's reaction to it as Yoda just comes down, smiles, and as Dave Filoni said at, I think it was a WonderCon panel over the weekend here, now Yoda has finally kind of come to accept and actually like the relationship that has been built, Padawan and Master, between Ahsoka and Anakin. That makes a nice counterpoint to the relationship concern that we saw and the fact that they set them up to have attachment so that Anakin can get over it that we saw back in the Clone Wars film, which I just watched the other day. So for me, that made for a great coda for this season.
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys. I really enjoy these episodes. I know that they've done a million different TV shows and movies about the hunting people to for sport premise, and it was still kind of fun when presented in a Star Wars kind of way. I enjoyed seeing the Trandoshan Wookiee kind of rivalry there a little bit, because that's something I've enjoyed from the EU, and seeing all the different Trandos was pretty cool too. All in all, really good episode, and I'm right with Nathan on that those final couple minutes with the exchange between Anakin and Ahsoka, and then Yoda's look, that part kind of did feel like a season finale, because if they were to come back first episode of season 4, if they try to keep them chronological, and it's Ahsoka being knighted, I would completely buy that and be ready for it at this point. So we'll see. But all in all, very good couple of episodes. Our first episode was Padawan Lost, and we'll kind of get started with our discussion there. But if we bleed into the other episode, it'll be okay. So this started out, because I hadn't seen anything before about where this episode was going to go. I mean, I knew what it was called. I knew at some point Ahsoka was going to be on her own, but I didn't. And I knew Trandoshans were going to show up at some point, but I didn't expect where it went. Started off with this massive battle on Felucia, which was very well represented, and there was a three-prong attack led by three different Jedi with a variety of clones. This in and of itself was pretty good. Now, but I have to wonder, was it action for action's sake, because we were kind of going to get the sneaking around later in the episode. So maybe they had to get the flashbang out of the way.
You know, speaking of just how well done that battle was, aside from the fact that we have jetpacks, we have the Trandoshan with his net gun and all that kind of stuff, did you notice the level of detail when it came to the scenery? There's a moment where our characters are in the background, and in the foreground there's this, I guess for lack of a better term, a plant. I'm not even sure what it is. There's bugs crawling all over it. It just really struck me like, wow, we have reached that point. Between that and seeing the preview for next season at the end with the new Padme model, I was really struck by how far the series has come. I know we've said that a lot this season, but once again, it's made very, very blatantly clear.
Yeah, I noticed those bugs on the plant too. Those jumped out to me to the point where I thought that was what Ahsoka was sensing. I thought somehow the bugs of Felucia were going to be what separated her from her master. Totally caught off guard by the Trando thing, which was great. I love being surprised by this show, and that was a really big surprise for me.
I wasn't missing anything. You know, last couple times we were on Felucia, I was like, where are the Rancors? Where is this? Where is that? When is this time? You know, they did have the whole battle going on. And what I really liked about the whole Felucia thing is it really set everything up. It kind of set up the Trandoshans as being a type of race that would actually go into the battle, go into an obviously separatist and republic active battle going on to look for prey to kidnap. And I'm like, wow, man. And this is where Boss comes from, you know. So it kind of earned their stripes there. And it took the battle to where it didn't prolong it out needlessly. You know, it only gave us enough battle we needed for Ahsoka to get kidnapped, and then we moved on. So I thought the first beginning of it, of being on Felucia, was great.
The battle is won for the Republic, but in the midst of it, Ahsoka has been captured by a raiding Trandoshan who is apparently just out seeing what he can find for their little hunting party. I didn't get the feeling that he was there because the Republic was there and he was hoping to catch a Padawan or a youngling. I think he may have been hunting Aklai and stumbled across Ahsoka.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at all the creatures that's like back at their base, that's just hanging on the wall, I think that was just like a lucky find. You know, like I was just looking for Felucian wildlife or natives or whatever they're hunting. It's like, oh my goodness, I got a Jedi, just like those other Jedis we had before. So, I mean, I think that was just like the lucky prey, you know, catch of the day.
What I thought was funny was they showed the Wampa carcass on there, which was totally bad A. I mean, you know, anybody could take down a Wampa is great. And then they showed the Wookiee carcass, and then there was a Gungan carcass. I was like, come on. And all how the hard fanboys to take down Jar Jar and mount him up. I mean, that was I thought that was the funniest part. And all of a sudden, you see the Wookiee, and then you know, and then Jar Jar.
Well, and then all of a sudden, all the fanboys are like, they didn't say Gungan. They say, hey, they killed Jar Jar. If we see the season 4 preview, which we can talk about in, I guess, our wrap-up show, but you look at the season 4 preview, there was a Gungan being shown in there that was doing some pretty bad stuff. So, Jar Jar is certainly the lesser Gungans. I'm sure there's some that are quite capable in their environment.
Yes, I agree, but I thought it was kind of funny, you know, because you would expect to see an Ackley or something, but you know, especially when Ahsoka is supposed to be young Dar, his first kill is supposed to be a Jedi youngling, a Padawan. So I just wondered whose first kill was the Gungan, like the Gungan style Trandoshan, who they sent after the Gungan.
That's like Charlie Brown in the Halloween saying, "Yeah, I got a rock."
Right.
What was your first kill?
Gungan. Right. And who was proud? What Trandoshan was proud to earn his stripes to kill Jar Jar or the Gungan, you know? So I just thought that was pretty funny that they added that.
I want to know whose first kill was the alien from Crystal Skull or the Mandalorian, the Neo-Crusader Mandalorian thousands of years ago. How old is this hunting lodge?
You know, one thing I really enjoyed was they really kind of tried to make the Trandoshans like raptors. I kind of got the kind of Jurassic Park raptor vibe out of it, how they were hunting in packs and the stripes, their skin were, you know, stripy, kind of like the Jurassic Park raptors and stuff like that. So, I mean, I just liked how they kind of filled that out, because the only other Trandoshan history I know of is from the Bounty Hunter book series, where Bosk, you know, steals Boba Fett's ship. And you have to help me out with that, Nathan. Which trilogy was that for the
Bounty Hunter Wars trilogy?
Yeah, great. That was a great set of books. But, you know, it kind of gave you a background of where Trandoshans are, of how they're kind of, you know, Bosk and his father, and how they kind of vie for power and stuff like that. But this really fleshed them out, giving them a whole culture, you know, a whole hunting culture. And you can really kind of know who these creatures are. And it's kind of standing them out as far as who they've been introducing in the whole series.
You know, that's one thing. I mean, they've delved into Trandoshan culture quite a bit before, starting with one of the early Galaxy Guides, as I recall. I think the Empire Strikes Back Galaxy Guide. And there's a great article on the development of the culture and the relation to the Wookiees in the most recent Insider issue, the one that's got the Charlie Sheen partying Ahsoka on the cover. But, you know, what struck me was I don't recall them ever being described as having the Velociraptor, I think it is, style sounds, the sort of barking to get each other's attention, to draw the other hunters in. And that certainly makes sense within the standpoint of them being these reptilian hunters. You want to give them some kind of other element to them to make them a little more alien. But at the same time, you know, it's something that I think a lot of EU fans or longtime Star Wars fans who have been following the Trandoshans are going to have to, they're going to have to get used to a little bit, because it's not quite the way it would have been expected.
Yeah, but that's one thing that wasn't as horribly jarring. I mean, it was surprising, and certainly since it's something that hasn't really been touched on that much, it wasn't totally like a continuity nuke or anything. That's not as bad as making the entire planet of Mandalore a bunch of pacifist bureaucrats. So,
oh, no. I mean, it's not, I'm not saying that it's something that changed anything that's going to be some kind of big freak out for people. I think it's just that people are going to have to get used to it. But I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, you see any number of cultures that are used. I mean, take, or a specific example, take Aayla Secura, right? Seeing Aayla Secura done as Amy Allen, as a live actress, as opposed to just being in a comic book, took a little while for people to get used to. Then people took a while to get used to her having the French sounding accent. It's not that it was something that destroyed something else or even contradicted something else, so much as it added a new layer that was unusual, and people are now still kind of getting used to it. I'm not saying there's anything negative about it. It's just one of those things that we're gonna have to sit back and say, huh, really? It was overdone in this episode, but as a new element for the characters, it works fairly well. I can imagine Bosk having that same type of thing, although you got to wonder why we didn't hear that type of sound coming from Bosk when we did see him in season 2. Either they didn't come up with the element beforehand, and certainly there have been multiple references to Jurassic Park in this season, or perhaps you don't make that sound when you're not around other Trandoshans who'd be able to pick up on it and use that as a guidance method.
It also may have something to do with the primal nature of these guys hunt. I mean, Bosk is, as far as a Trandoshan is, he's a more universal being. He's more worldly. He's out there having to interact with other species, other beings who aren't going to get the animalistic squeals and grunts and all that. When these guys are hunting in packs with their own kind, then that's how they act. So So these younglings who have been captured on various training missions and brought there to be hunted as well. And Ahsoka, because she's been so well trained by Anakin, just takes the helm and she's the boss now. And she's going to tell them how it's done and how it should be done.
You know, Dan, I'm glad you pointed out that they're younglings, not Padawans. I hadn't picked up on that. And throughout the episode, I thought, man, these other Jedi just suck. I mean, are you kidding? I can't believe they can't do this. They can't do that. But I'm glad you said that, because I did have in my head they're Padawans, because they seemed a little old for younglings. But did we have an idea of how long they had been there? I mean, were they younglings and they just like are starting to just get older because they've been there for like a couple of years? Or
we got the sense they'd been there for a while, long enough for Khalifa to basically say they've got enough experience to have survived. Therefore, Ahsoka should respect that in a sense. But remember, I mean, Ahsoka just became a Padawan when she was 14 years old back in the film. I mean, you're a youngling all the way up until you're taken as a Padawan. So, you know, if you're 13 years old, then you're still considered a youngling in that particular respect.
Gotcha.
I will say, though, for ones who, it seems, I'm assuming they probably got a lot of training on the fly. They had to train themselves to survive, in a sense. It wasn't all their Jedi training. I must say that I was surprised by some of their fighting abilities. I mean, we see an instance where I think it's Jinx is grabbed by Omer and slung like a cannonball into one of the Trandoshans, which works really, really well. These characters have amazing jumping abilities, except when Ahsoka needs to get on top of the hunting lodge and needs a Wookiee to throw her. They've got these amazing jumping abilities. And Khalifa, quite frankly, I think she's a case to prove that Wile E. Coyote had midichlorians, because she winds up falling and falling and falling and falling, and it's all right, she's okay. Till she gets shot, she's good. She's just a little bit winded, she's all right. But no, it seemed like they were older for younglings, but certainly were younglings, because if you look at when they're side by side with Ahsoka, they seem a little more diminutive compared to her, a little bit shorter, a little bit smaller in stature. I think they did a very good job of making these characters appear experienced of living on the world, and yet at the same time, young enough that Ahsoka would be someone they would normally, in regular society, have had to look up to. That worked somewhat well.
I really enjoyed the Padawans, or the younglings, and I agree with you guys how it was interesting that they were still called younglings with the amount of force ability that they had. You know, like you had mentioned before about the cannonball ability, where, you know, the Padawan had jumped, the Twi'lek Padawan had jumped, and then the other Padawan grabbed him with the Force to use him as a weapon. And what really surprised me is when Khalifa was force choking the Trandoshan. And because I'm under the impression that Padawans learn, not all Padawans know every Force ability. You know, they all don't have Force techniques. They develop the Force techniques that and fighting styles that their masters have. Right. So someone was teaching him this. So I was wondering who was teaching Khalifa the force choke. You know, is that a Jedi ability, training ability, or is that something that you develop yourself as your force abilities? Kind of, that's just something that comes out, you know. And I also found it interesting. I always like the fact that each Jedi is always on just right on the fence of turning to the dark side. You know, it doesn't matter how long you've been a Jedi. It's just like, unless you follow these strict rules and you follow your life the way it is and don't have any connections and follow the rules, you know, you're always just that close to coming to the dark side. And I love that.
See, I thought they demonstrated enough force power to where you kind of felt like that, yeah, they should be able to get out of this. But then there are times you're just like, oh, come on, keep doing that thing you're doing where you whip the gun back and forth before they shoot it, or can't you just yank the gun or crush the gun, or can't you do something else? But I guess it goes back to some of the apologetics that I brought into this in episodes past and seasons past, where it's just like, you know, in the heat of the moment with inexperience, you might know how to, you know, do it once or twice, and then you just get fatigued. You know, it's the example I used a couple years ago. It's like, you know, in the pregame warm up, a field goal kicker can hit a 60 yarder, but in a game, never. So okay, fine, but there are times I was like, man, just like shove the Trandoshan dude into something. Why do you keep just like yanking his gun back and forth?
You know, especially since these Trandoshans seem to be really easily taken out by, you know, falling. They can do just about everything else, But when they fall, they die.
You know, Jerry, you brought up a good interesting point about the Force use and how they were skilled enough that they should have been able to get off that rock. But at the same time, they were kind of defeatist in their mind. Like, every time they wanted to do something, they were telling about how they couldn't do anything and, you know, woe is me and stuff like that. So it kind of made sense that they were kind of trapped there. But
it is because of their defeatist attitude that Ahsoka says, well, she's going to go out and take them out on her own, whether they help or not, since they're all decided that they're going to go and keep running. So Ahsoka goes and goes hunting for Lizard. Here, Lizard, Lizard. And lo and behold, that must have been enough to motivate the others because they come to her aid.
You notice what Ahsoka says when she does do that instinctive force choke thing? No, we don't kill out of hatred. Okay, this is a matter of survival. She might have been hating as she was killing, but isn't everybody better off if the Trandoshan was dead? Isn't that basically what they wind up having to do throughout the entire rest of this two-parter? Let's bring in some practicality here. I mean, granted, I know Tarkin was whining about how the Jedi aren't willing to go far enough, but in this situation, I think it's time to let the scaly bodies hit the floor.
Yeah, that always annoys me. And I know it's a kid's show, blah, 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 but this is a severe act of war and death, and by leaving him alive or leaving any of them alive, I mean, what are you going to do? Like, when we escape, we can come back and arrest them and bring them to justice. Come on. No, that's a scenario where you've got to do what you got to do. I mean, that's the Anakin thrusting the lightsaber through the one center and saying, what? He's going to blow up the ship. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. Good move. I mean, everyone's like, oh, wow, what a dark moment. And Anakin, I can't believe you did that. It's like, no, that was the right thing to do, people, in that situation. Similar to what Ahsoka, you know, granted, she didn't kill out of hatred in the guy that was going to, you know, toss Tarkin into the sulfur pit or whatever. But that was like, you know, this isn't just a moment of I'm just doing it and this is my path to the dark side. These are people trying to hunt me down for game. Shouldn't even be a question. Snap his little neck. And let's go.
Or maybe at least have somebody else take him out, you know, like, okay, if it would cross the line for Khalifa because of her emotions at that moment and pull her to the dark side, if she killed him with the force choke, then fine. Have her let him go and then everybody else kill him with clear consciences because they're only doing it for protection.
I thought that's what was going to happen, Nathan. I thought exactly that's what was going to happen, that Ahsoka was going to kill, just like Anakin did. You know, you brought up how Anakin put that saber through the chest. Well, when Satine had the opportunity to shoot the guy, and he was like, what, are you going to shoot me? And then you won't be sticking to your beliefs of a pacifist. When Anakin kills the guy, it wasn't out of hate. It was out of necessity. So I really thought that it is a difference. It is a difference when you kill out of hate. I thought that Ahsoka was going to say, let me do it, and then was going to lop off his head or something. And I thought that was going to be the okay killing.
See, I thought it was more just a forced choke. Was the hatred, was the dancing with the dark side. Now that she just tossed him off the edge and let him fall to his death like everybody else, that would have been okay. So the younglings split into two groups, Ahsoka and Khalifa, Jinx and Omer. And Ahsoka and Khalifa have another encounter with young Dar. And just as it seems he's about to get the drop on Khalifa after injuring her arm, Ahsoka pushes him off a branch, and as we mentioned before, he dies. And then, to the shock of everybody, Khalifa catches a blaster bolt. At least it was a shock to me, because, I mean, these are kids. I did not expect to see any of them die. Of all the people that we've seen die in three seasons of Clone Wars, I really did not expect them to go all the way to killing a young teenager or a pre-teenager or however old those kids were supposed to be. That surprised me. That showed some major cojones, I felt.
At least the way they showed it. I mean, she not only got shot, you see it blast through her. That, I think, was a shock to me. I mean, seeing her maybe shot in the back, that's one thing. But seeing her shot through and through, that really surprised me. Since we're on the subject, let's note here that, you know, she does get shot through and through. But, number one, it is a disturbing death. Because you notice there that when she dies, it's not just she slumps. She slumps with her mouth open, like just, like literally. She dies in that second. It's not the stereotypical Star Wars, and then the eyes close and the mouth closes, and it's like they go to sleep. I mean, this is just a straight-up visceral death. This was not as if she lost the will to live. She didn't have a choice.
You know what I really liked about the death is that it really worked. I mean, the whole, you really wanted Khalifa to survive, to get on that rescue ship and become a strong Jedi Knight, because she reminded me of, for some reason, her whole character design just reminded me of a Jedi that should have been a Jedi. And when they had the scene where Ahsoka's about to walk away, and she has her back turned, and the Trandoshan's using his blaster trying to shoot her, and Ahsoka's been in so many battle situations that it's not even bothering her. She knows that the guy's not in the line of sight, and the blasters are just going past her, and she just kind of has her back turned and her head down. I mean, that is something that if they could put that on an art print, I would buy that, because that was so powerful. Just that image of the dead youngling there, and Ahsoka having to put her head down with her back to walk away with the blasters going by, I just thought, wow. I mean, they're just taking this to a whole different level.
So we leave Khalifa's death and the ranting of Garnak, and we flash all the way to Coruscant, where Anakin is brooding about having to leave without Ahsoka and that he can't find her. And he gets a little bit of a pep talk, more of a smack upside the head from Plo Koon, who really has some interesting theories on this whole thing, I thought. Telling him basically to sit down, shut up, if you did your job, she'll find her way home.
Which means that if she dies, it's your fault.
Your fault.
Yeah, I suppose I can go the other way too, but I also took that as the, well, we're in a war, things happen, you can't be that attached, everything's going to play out the way it's supposed to play out based on her training, will of the force, et cetera, we can't, you know, leave the army, the squadron here, Wolfpack or whatever, here for days and weeks just searching for Ahsoka, which, you know, great advice, because she wasn't there. Guys, you're not going to find her. And, you know, I know we didn't really talk about this too much, but I thought it was really interesting. It was kind of scary. It's like, all right, these three squadrons go in, they conquer this base, everything's great, we did awesome, hey, where's Ahsoka? And there's like no clue. So you kind of, I really got the feeling of like Anakin's desperation here. It's like, oh my God, this is not a victory anymore, because where's Ahsoka? Where's Ahsoka? Where's Ahsoka? I don't even care about the war right now. You know, we screwed up. We messed up. I got the desperation in his voice and his actions, where he's like, well, not good enough. Keep looking, keep looking. And I thought it was kind of funny, because it's like, well, that's not good enough. Look again. And like 5 seconds later, all right, guys, let's go.
You know, I think it shows some maturity to his character that he is willing to leave when Plo says it's time to leave, even though he doesn't want to. But then, of course, we see him brooding at the end of the episode, so we know he hasn't let go of it, and he's feeling the guilt of all of that. I think that makes the ending conversation of Wookiee Hunt all the much more appropriate, and the emotions there coming from Anakin all the much more appropriate, instead of it just being him whining about how things were his fault. He's carrying around this guilt very heavily, and we usually don't see that much in this series, or specifically with Anakin in the series, where he's really carrying around guilt for an action. He usually is so sure of himself that in this case, it's really eating at him, and I think it plays fairly well.
Well, and it makes a lot of sense, too, because, I mean, by this time, he obviously is still carrying the guilt about his mother, and then it's a bridging point between the movies, because everything he does in episode 3 is because he wants to avoid further guilt for something that's going to happen to Padme, right? So it's definitely in his character to carry that around and fuel him. And you know, it's amazing he didn't do something drastic, although that just wasn't the story being told here. You know, left the army, left the Republic, went on his own, went AWOL to try to find her. I mean, it's kind of amazing, actually, now that I think about it, that Anakin didn't end up on this planet trying to find her. But like I said, that's obviously not the story they're looking to tell here, but it's consistent with what Anakin's done in the movies.
Yeah, that really surprised me that he never showed up trying to find her. And as far as we know, all he's done is broodingly stare at a map. Because I know, at least, when we first saw this preview and there was the clip where he was being told to let her find her way or not go looking for her, I at least said, there's no way he's going to let that happen, because that's not Anakin's way. He doesn't let that happen. But he ended up letting it happen, which is very surprising.
Didn't have a lot of choice in the matter. I mean, even if he had gone back to Felucia, he wouldn't have been able to find anything at that point. And I really like the fact that the Jedi aren't the ones that swing in and save the day. in the end. It's somebody else. This would have been so cliche Star Wars to have them get in a desperate situation, and oh look, at the very end, here comes a la Attack of the Clones, here comes the Jedi swinging in with their gunships and everything, and now the day is saved. And granted, the day was saved by someone else who brings aid, but it wasn't the Jedi. As soon as a transmitter starts working in Wookiee Hunt, I'm thinking, oh, here we go. It's just going to be Anakin showing up to save the day. It's the same old stuff it feels like we've seen a million times. And it wasn't. Instead, Anakin is forced to be restrained, in a sense, in his actions here. And that opens the door to a different storytelling possibility in the end. I really think that they played this out much better than it could have gone. Because we see them travel down the same road so often, it's almost a shock when they actually diverge and come up with something truly new.
Oh, I totally agree with you, Nathan. I wouldn't have wanted to see that story, but it, like Dan said, surprises me that they didn't do it that way. But you're absolutely right. It was better. The story that they told and they wanted to tell here, I think came off really, you know, really well. But I'm surprised Anakin wasn't the one. You're right. It would have been totally cliche.
The second episode, Wookiee Hunt, starts out with the surviving younglings proposing an attack on the prisoner ship when it comes to drop off its next batch. And how they know exactly when it's going to be dropping off, it's a little bit odd, but they do. So they make an assault on the prisoner ship, which apparently, from what they said, was only carrying one prisoner. That seems horribly wasteful. In this economy, to drive a ship that size, that far, with just one prisoner really isn't thinking with your wallet at all.
Apparently the Trandoshans have a renewable sustainable resource for their fuel.
So the three younglings, Padawans, managed to bring down the ship, and there is a survivor, and we are introduced in his Clone Wars debut to Chewbacca, which it was nice to see them do an original trilogy character in a period that didn't totally destroy anything as far as a backstory that's too established. But and I think one of our voicemails comments on this, Chewbacca seemed to be made of the same substance as Obi-Wan's beard.
Very true. Now, can I ask, I need to ask a question out there to all my fellow Shakespeare fans, but I'm a big fan of Hamlet. And there's one line early on in Hamlet. It's, "Halt, stand and unfold yourself." And when I saw Chewbacca stand the way that he did, I couldn't help but shout out the Hamlet line. Any other super Hamlet literary nerds out there think that same thing? Because he really was unfolding. It was like the T-1000 standing in that one scene in Terminator 2 where he just bends from completely folded over. He's like Gumby.
I, for one, was so excited to hear about Chewbacca being in the Clone Wars. And seeing his debut did not disappoint. I actually got goosebumps when I saw him debut because he was standing kind of weird and he kind of does the little roar and he puts his head kind of to the side. And that was like totally Chewbacca. And I love the fact that his character design has the little puffs at the end of his hands. So it kind of covers his palms and his fingers. And he still kind of has that skinny look to his arms. And I really got goosebumps. And I think this was the first time that they brought an original trilogy character in that I was excited about. It did not give me goosebumps to see Cy Snoodle be introduced and kill Zero the Hutt. You know, even though it was exciting, but it didn't give me the goosebumps. It didn't give me goosebumps to see Greedo come in. So this was the one time where I was really excited. And I really think they got the way that he was moving was everything was just Chewbacca-esque. What I found interesting is they actually brought in Peter Mayhew to do the voice of Chewbacca. It's like, why? And it was, I was reading it, it's like he said, oh, I've been, you know, he's been studying the voice of Chewbacca so he could get it right. And I'm like, did they really need to bring him in? You know, don't they have all the roars and stuff? And I just wonder how true that was. So, Nathan, you're going to have to help me with that link. What was the link?
www.starwars.com/theclonewars, all is one word, /Chewbacca_weekly/index.html. It's an article, if you use search, called Chewbacca in the Clone Wars, Animating a Walking Carpet, from February 24th, 2011.
And speaking of the voice, I'm glad they didn't cop out and let Chewbacca speak basic like they did with Greedo. They kind of had to cheat where Ahsoka understood Chewbacca, where I don't know why Ahsoka would understand Chewbacca, but she, you know, we kind of had to have that. And well, so he would speak basic, or so he wasn't writing on a pad or something.
Well, Filoni apparently said at, I guess it was Filoni at WonderCon, that the reason was because she learned that interpretation, the ability to interpret Shriwook, when she was in early training. And part of me would say that's kind of a cop-out, but at the same time, I mean, we mentioned earlier, I think it was Barrett who said earlier about how it seems like, maybe it was Jerry, that the Jedi have the skills that they get from their masters. But when we first met Ahsoka, she was using the lightsaber in a reverse grip. That was not something she learned from Anakin, even though she does have it in common with Starkiller, who does learn, presumably, from Vader slash Anakin. So there is at least some advanced training that she gets beyond, you know, just classroom stuff when she's younger.
Number one, Barrett, there would have been a riot if Chewbacca spoke basic. There would have been a flat-out riot. I mean, Dave Filoni would have had to have hired personal security. I mean, to the level of Secret Service, okay?
Killed Chewbacca all over again.
Yeah, it's like, okay, Salvatore killed his body, what, 20 years after Return of the Jedi, but you killed his soul by making him speak basic. I don't know, did Ahsoka have any association with other Jedi, like a Plo Koon or somebody who may have spent time on Kashyyyk?
Yoda has some type of favorable relations with the Wookiees. He was at one point the watchman for the sector that has Kashyyyk in it. Maybe that's what gets it into the Jedi Academy or the Jedi Temple's curriculum. I mean, it could be just about anything, especially, I mean, if the Wookiees are expected to be a possible front line in the Clone Wars, okay, then it would make sense that their strategic importance of their planet, one way or the other, might have caused Shriwook to be something that you might teach. If not being able to speak it, because I don't think we've seen very many characters able to speak Shriwook that's not a droid or an actual Wookiee, but just the ability to interpret what you're hearing. I mean, Han is able to interpret it, and Han was educated, well, between being on the run and everything, he winds up getting whatever formal education he gets through the Empire, of all places, and still comes out being able to speak Wookiee. Although I guess that was from Delwana that he would have learned that as he was growing up. But, I mean, it's something that is available as something you can learn. I mean, it's not like it's an archaic language that nobody might ever be able to use in practical terms.
Regardless, it worked. And I like the fact better, Jerry. You're absolutely right. It would have been, people would have been up in arms if he would have been speaking basic. But that fact, and another thing that goes along with what you said earlier, Jerry, about how Ahsoka has kind of come into her own Jedi, and I totally agree with you on that, where it doesn't bother me to see a whole story arc revolve around Ahsoka, because she is the star now. You know, she has grown up. And I like the fact that if it wasn't for Ahsoka, she saved Chewbacca's life. You know, she stopped the crash from happening or ejected the pod so, you know, he could save. And I like that fact that, you know, a Clone Wars character has saved an original character trilogy's life. I like that.
You know, also speaking of Ahsoka coming into her own as we're moving into Wookiee Hunt, but between both of these two episodes, most of the time Ahsoka does not have her lightsabers. And she does an amazing job of fighting without the lightsabers. Now, granted, you know, Chewbacca, when they capture him, maybe because he just didn't want to get too close to him, still has his bandolier and apparently a purse. But Ahsoka does not have her lightsabers throughout pretty much the entirety of these episodes, minus Felucia. And she kicks some serious butt. I mean, the fighting moves that she has are really well done, really well choreographed. It shows strength for the character. And they even go to the nuances of sort of the fighting stance as she's walking through the hunting lodge, where she has sort of her fingers curled up. And I want to say it's Kung Fu that has a specific stance very similar to the one that she was using. But they really have done a good job of making her sort of the butt kicker who doesn't need the lightsaber. She is past the point where she has to rely on the standard tools. She is in and of herself a living weapon, and that works really well for developing this character in a strength without them having to beat us over the head with my, how you've grown up, and a bunch of clumsy dialogue. We see it in her actions.
So Chewbacca tells Ahsoka that he thinks he can build a transmitter to call for help from the wreckage of the ship. He thinks he saw an umbrella and a speak and spell, you know, a couple things that he could use. So Ahsoka and Chewbacca go back to ransack the ship while Jinx and Omer look out. And while Ahsoka and Chewie are inside, Atrando lands and is ambushed by the two younglings and used to call for a pod to get the group onto the floating hunting lodge.
What strikes me about that whole sequence with the sniper, with Smug, Jeff Anderson, as the sniper there, is I really kind of felt that sense of peril. Granted, we don't expect Ahsoka to die, but perhaps to get injured or something along the way. I think this was one of the first episodes where I really kind of felt a sense of elevated peril for Ahsoka, beyond anything we've ever seen before. To get injured, to somehow need to be saved because she is heavily harmed. I mean, I didn't even feel this level of worry about Ahsoka back during the Brain Invaders and all those story arcs when she and Luminara wind up in that broader arc being essentially buried under debris and such. It really sort of felt like there was a danger there. Her spider sense wasn't tingling when we had the sniper getting ready to shoot her, and if the others hadn't been there, she or Chewbacca might have been gravely injured. They really ratcheted up the tension in these episodes for as much as they could. We couldn't see Chewbacca die. We couldn't see Ahsoka die, but injuries perhaps, deaths to other characters. We'd already seen one shot through. I don't know. Did you guys feel any sense of that tension here? Or was this kind of a, oh, well, they'll take him out. No need to worry.
No, I definitely felt a tension because, I mean, we're coming to a point in the Clone Wars. We're far enough in the Clone Wars. And yes, everybody says there's no way they're going to kill Ahsoka. There's no way she's going to die. She's going to survive the series and somehow be worked in to where she's still around. I'm not 100% on that boat. I still think there is a chance Ahsoka is going to become one with the Force within the final few episodes, if not some big series finale movie thing. So Ahsoka is ripe for the plucking, and the way they've been killing off characters this season, her getting injured to the point where she died in Anakin's arms after the rescue came, that would have been completely plausible in my book. So there was some, this could be it. This could, something's going to happen here.
See, I didn't get any tension there. I mean, it was Chewbacca and Ahsoka. It's like, nothing's going to happen here. Nothing could happen here. So I didn't feel that. Dan, I'm really thinking that Ahsoka is going to make it, you know, all the way throughout the series. I don't think they'll kill her off just because of the nature of the show. I think she's more of a, she'll somehow leave Anakin, find a new teacher, you know, master, whatever, and she'll play into his dark side that way. But I don't think we're going to see it, and we're certainly not going to see it at the end of season three. I mean, it was too early in the show for it to be a she took a bullet and, you know, find out season four what happens type thing. So it was more of a, not the tension of what's going to happen to them, but how are they going to, you know, what are they going to do to this sniper to keep him from bringing the rain down on him? And, you know, that's where those two other learners come in and actually do a pretty good job.
I'm with you, Dan. I think Ahsoka's going to get it. The fact of the matter is that a lot of our characters, our beloved characters like Luke and Anakin, they lose limbs. You know, they've had things cut off. So there's always that chance that Ahsoka could lose a leg or a hand or something like that and get a kind of a prosthetic where she could be injured. But I'm in the camp of Ahsoka. For me, Ahsoka has to die for two reasons. One, it opens up the fact that when you start getting towards the end of the Clone Wars, if Ahsoka gets taken out, that means Anakin can kind of go on to his own adventures and develop that dark side. You know, he gets closer and closer to the dark side, and that's one way that would help him get there. So then again, I did predict that Rex would die a few episodes ago, so I have been wrong, but I'm in the camp with you, Dan. I think that in order for Anakin to have made that leap in episode 3 to where he could not see another person die that was close to him, I think Ahsoka has to go.
Nah, this is my chance to disagree with Barrett. I'm with Jerry. I don't think it's going to happen. At least not within the confines of the show itself, because of the target audience, what she means to the female viewers and all that kind of stuff. I really don't think they're going to do it.
But you know, along with what Brent was saying, her getting seriously maimed, losing a limb, that's something that's not necessarily limited by the confines of the audience. Last summer, was it the summer before? I don't know. Kids movie, a year or so old, How to Train Your Dragon. And the end of the movie, spoiler alert, the main character loses his leg and has a prosthetic. That's not new, surprising stuff for kids. So that's something that they could honestly use.
Oh, you know, I could buy into that. If something like that happened, I'd be like, oh, wow, that's pretty interesting that she's a casualty of war like that. But to me, that is nowhere near the level of, yep, we're gonna offer halfway through season four. You know, because there they just put a, you know, like Anakin, they put a glove and a different type of top on her or different type of pants it covered, and it becomes a non-issue in episodes afterwards. It's totally different, though, if she dies and how Anakin, like, becomes psycho afterwards.
So Chewbacca builds his transmitter, but before it is completely working, it is decided that it is time for a final assault on the Flying Fortress. The younglings and Chewbacca take their captive Trandoshan to capture a gun pod and go up to the flying hunting lodge and assault the hunters head on. So there's lizards flying all over the place and people are shooting, and Omer gets to drive the pod around and try to shoot people and miss like crazy. A nice little battle here. Everybody's kind of pulling out their stops and fighting as though their life depended on it. Oh, because it does. I, for one, was very disappointed. I know it's a kid's show and all, we couldn't see it. I was very disappointed we did not see Chewbacca take the opportunity to pull Atrando's arm off. I mean, come on, that's what they're known for. And we know it'll grow back, so what's the big deal?
That's apparently something Filoni said they were really wrestling with during the WonderCon panel. But yeah, apparently you can't do that.
You know, all I can say is during this battle, this siege on the fortress, I was just drooling. Look at all the beautiful toys they could make. These platforms, Omer with the platform, Chewbacca, and I thought it was a cool way of Ahsoka to accept the plan of the Padawans, of these younglings, and go ahead and go with that plan. Because usually, what usually happens in a situation like this is the leader kind of stands their ground and says, no, 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 I'm right, you're wrong, you have to follow me, and usually is. But in this case, it was the right thing to do for Ahsoka to go ahead and listen to their plan. So I really enjoyed that.
You know, speaking of defying convention here, the normal outcome would have been, well, they're against all odds, but they managed to persevere on their own. And instead, we get a point, I guess it's late in the battle, where Radder is beating the living crap out of Chewbacca and needs, I think it's Omer's help in order to finally get the upper hand on him and throw him overboard. And we get a point right there before the Halo shows up to bring reinforcements, in a sense here, where they're all down. They're all held at gunpoint. They attacked a presumably superior force, at least in terms of numbers and armaments, and they got their butts kicked. I mean, they kicked a lot of butt, but in the end, had they not had help, they were in deep guano. And that was, again, it was a nice change of pace from the cliches that we could have expected out of that scene. I expected just a full-on assault. The idea of anyone coming to help, if it had not been the Jedi, was never something I had considered at all. When they look up and the Halo is coming down and we see the cockpit and Sugi and Serapas are in there, I literally went, yes, really, really loud and went, Sugi! Which I probably shouldn't admit to saying that way, but I was extremely excited to see that. You know, that was just, it was the twist ending that M. Night Shyamalan should take note of, because this one actually made sense.
Yeah, you know, what I expected to happen, I mean, Nathan, I'm about half with you in terms of kind of like the typical convention leads to something else. I was expecting, since these two other younglings were kind of chicken to go off and do anything at first, but then they got inspired by Ahsoka and by, you know, what happened to their friend. But it seemed like they were running before they could walk, and they're like, no, we're gonna take a Trandoshan, and we're gonna make him take us to the fortress, and then we're gonna take it. As soon as they said that, I was like, oh yeah, you guys are so dead. I mean, you're gonna take him between the eyes. I mean, I at least one of them I thought was going to actually bite it. But they actually were, you know, really, based on the way the show played out, it's like, no, those guys really had the right idea. That was the plan to go with. And really, I wasn't surprised about somebody coming to their rescue, because you get this scene where everyone else leaves, and then that transmitter that Chewbacca built, like, suddenly starts working. So you're like, oh, it's getting a signal out. Okay. I mean, to me, that's the gun in the first act that's being fired in the third act.
How many times, though, do we see something like that where, a call for help goes out, and the help doesn't arrive until help is no longer needed? I mean, that's basically what we see frequently in any sci-fi series, let alone in Star Wars. To have the help actually arrive and do some good was something that, again, to me kind of felt like it was out of left field. I expected the transmitter to work, they kick everybody's butt, and when it's done, the Jedi show up or somebody shows up and it's, what kept you? That kind of thing again. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking. When the transmitter went off, I'm like, oh, here comes help. They're going to get there. Everything's going to be under control. Ahsoka's going to be sitting on top of a pile of unconscious Trandoshans, and Anakin's going to walk up and say, well, looks like you got it all under control here, Snips. And she's going to say something stupid right back.
And yeah, that was perfect.
The end. That's how I expected it. But instead, we get that moment where they're all on the ground at gunpoint, and we look up. And even then, it surprised me because, like Nathan said, it's the silhouette of the halo we see above them, not the silhouette of the belly of a gunship. So this one just kept on surprising me with where it went. It was really good.
Is there a reason why Wookiees are dealing with bounty hunters to go rescue people?
I just assumed they were working with them on something else on Kashyyyk and hired them real quick. Hey, you know, we just got a distress call. You're here and you're available. Let's go save them. You know, maybe there's a web comic in our future that'll describe how that happens. I did find it interesting that that Serapos was there too, because you got to wonder what happened to the few bounty hunters that were around that we've seen that haven't been taken out by someone else, or the ones that actually had some positivity to add on the light side, so to speak, of the story. It was interesting to see both of them back again. They had used Sugi in the background of Sphere of Influence, but beyond that, we really hadn't seen these characters return. And I remember one of our complaints back when we reviewed Bounty Hunters was they felt that these little one-off characters who weren't really like the Bounty Hunters we would expect. And here they are as mercenaries for hire for good things, again, in a sense, and they weren't just one-off characters who were going to disappear. I like that. It's delving into the show's own mythology to develop it. It could have been anyone else, or it could have been the Wookiees flying their own ship. And instead, here's a quick little nod to those who've been following, and they're not going to make a big deal out of it. Ahsoka is not going to wind up saying, you wouldn't believe what it was that saved us. It's those ones you said you ran into before, or anything like that. Nothing clumsy with it.
I did like that. I did like to see that, because that kind of introduces the idea that you can see anyone anywhere. You know, that we could see Darth Maul come at any time. He could come on a ship somewhere, you know, and I like that. And you're absolutely right, Nathan. I just had to agree with you because we disagree so much. But when the halo came and I saw the Wookiees, I did cheer out. That was one of the times where I was like, yes, yes. You know, this is a rescue. You know, I enjoy seeing Wookiees in combat. You know what I mean? There's just something about those big furry people that are just, you know, and the way that the Trandoshans are kind of scared of them, or not, at least not scared, but give them respect, you know. And I had no background with, you know, their rivalry, but that was one of the times where I was like, yes, you know, it was nice to see Tarful and the other Wookiees.
All right, so the day is saved by a few bounty hunters and some extra Wookiees, to the surprise of all, and they're nice enough to fly Ahsoka and the two surviving younglings back to Coruscant, where she's reunited with her master in a very touching moment. But actually, in all seriousness, the exchange there at the end, as we've touched on before, was very good. It actually brought the fortune cookie full circle. She learned, and in a way, he learned too. He learned he can't go gallivanting, running off to the galaxy, not having a thorough plan. So it went really well, and once again, we have that look from Yoda that just says she's going to be a knight now. I think it's going to happen.
As much as I would usually have argued that we weren't going to see that anytime, at least in the near future in the series, I'm right there with you. My first thought on seeing that was, whoa, could it have been that what she just went through, in a sense, was her Jedi trial, her trial by fire? Because at least within the context of the EU, there have been times where a character going through a major ordeal has been considered their Jedi trial instead of having something specific, say, set up for them as a trial. I really would not be surprised to see her knighted sometime in season four.
Actually, the more you guys talk about it, I'm warming up to the idea. I think that, you know, I've always said that it's going to be Ahsoka going to be kind of turning her back on Anakin, saying, hey, I need a different type of training from somebody else. I'm leaving you. It might just be that he's, you know, maybe he's just turned to the fact that, hey, she's just no longer my side. And maybe she, I don't know, I guess in a way she is surpassing him. So, I mean, you know, Dan, to your earlier comment, yeah, he's kind of learning the sense that, hey, maybe this training I'm doing is actually good. Maybe I am a lot better at this than I thought. And I don't know, maybe he's going to, you know, Anakin's going to end up having a hard time dealing with the fact that little 16-year-old Ahsoka is a knight already. I mean, heck, I was, you know, so old and I did all this, and they finally, and they really just, I mean, if the Tarkovsky series is any indication, they just made him a knight because they're kind of running out of them, you know, is the way I interpret it. It's like, hey, we need to advance them. Maybe that's Ahsoka's story too, because we're obviously even further into the war. It feels, based on what I'm still seeing about Ahsoka, it would be really premature, even though she's done some pretty good things. She's also still botched a few things, but yeah, I'm warming up to the idea. I can see it.
It would also explain where Rex goes if he goes with her as her primary clone commander, as opposed to being with Anakin, and if in doing so he has to leave the 501st, because the 501st is still with Anakin, it would explain them having a new commander for Revenge of the Sith and so forth. I mean, I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but certainly within this season, or maybe even the next season, either 4 or 5, it would make for a positive way to move her out of the Padawan position and get Rex taken care of, all still leaving them alive and well to either survive Order 66 later or otherwise. Because, you know, in that preview, there is that conversation going on, and I think it's Rex in the scene about how, you know, someday this war will be over. Huh. With Rex already having met the deserter, maybe there's a situation in which Ahsoka could go off with Rex, only to wind up having Order 66 come, and then Rex refuses it, which is very rare, but it does happen. Rex refuses it, and you've got Ahsoka and Rex out there still gallivanting around, sort of saving the day where they can. It'd make for a much better ending than all the things we keep thinking of, where it's, oh, she's going to go pull to the dark side, or she's going to get sick of him, or she's going to die, or whatever. Her knighting opens up some doors.
Yeah, because, I mean, clearly Rex has to go away at some point, because at the end of episode 3, or the beginning of the novel Dark Lord, I mean, we've seen the action figure too. Isn't his commander of the 501st commander, or Captain Apo?
Yeah, and that's who it is in Revenge of the Sith, if I remember correctly. So, I mean, it's definitely not Rex in Revenge of the Sith. So someone else is in charge of the 501st by that point.
I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I think these are strong possibilities, and maybe, you know, when we do our wrap-up for show and, you know, kind of do our looking forwards to season 4, I think that's you've given me some new things to think about. Okay, you know, Barrett, I'm with you. I think that one-on-one fight, and just kind of, it's kind of like what we've been talking about with Ahsoka and her capability. And yeah, has she went through a trial? Is she Jedi Knight worthy? Yeah, I think we've, you know, seen her, you know, following that Wolverine Colossus type cannonball thing, you know, where Chewbacca just like grabs her and chucks her up, you know, up to the top, gives her that extra boost. She goes in there, and the one-on-one fight with the leader there, which kind of surprised me, because I'm kind of wish she had been that effective all throughout the episode and really just taken out some of the other ones. But I was really impressed with how she went to town on him. I mean, it wasn't a straight up, you know, she dominated the fight, but she fought very well, but then fought smarter to where, you know, she got the victory at the end. And just even the scenery, we talked about this earlier about everything in that room and what it looked like, and kind of just the setting and the mood of that final, you know, boss battle, let's call it, going video games on it here, but that final boss battle at the end of the show, I thought was really effective. And I'm glad it was her doing it and not just, hey, let's send a Wookiee up there and just, you know, rip his head off.
Speaking of just of that final fight, I mean, I would hope that she would be extremely effective in that final fight, because apparently she saved all of her energy from not having to make that jump for herself, like every other character. And I think even she was able to do earlier in the episode. I mean, Plo Koon launches off, and they have to follow him on jetpacks, okay, at the beginning of Padawan Lost. And she and the Padawans are jumping like mad, only now it's, hey, can you throw me up there? I guess Chewbacca was just... She was just wanting to make sure Chewbacca felt like he had something to do. I like the fact, though, at the end of the battle, A, she looks like she's been through hell. You know, I mean, she looks like... Again, she's been through a Charlie Sheen party. She is covered in dust. So she has a different look to her in a lot of ways. It looks like she's gone through a lot of stuff. There is no lightsaber involved in the entire fight, of course. And she has that moment, essentially, of almost exasperation. Like, she is just... You know, she's still ready to fight, but she makes that line, the you're beaten. And the way she delivers that is so just, I'm tired of this. I've fought. I've kicked your butt. Don't get back up. That kind of phrasing of it. And then, yeah, you got the cliche, don't. And of course, he makes a lunge for a weapon and she has to blast him out the window, of course, or the door in order to finally kill him or finally cause him to fall and presumably die, because it seems like they're constantly dying when they're falling, as I said. Maybe it's a genetic thing, him and Dar, except he didn't fall on any invisible spikes. I mean, spikes. But I don't know. I think that they played it out well, not just in the fighting itself, though, but in the way that they handled her. I mean, she didn't just end it and wind up all cocky there at the end, like, ha, I beat you, that kind of thing. She doesn't come out looking all pristine like half the characters we see during fights where the Jedi just blaze through and it's like nothing happened, especially in things like Revenge of the Sith, where they're even making jokes about it after the battles are over with. She really seems like she's put a lot of effort into this, and you sort of feel that exhaustion with the character. Not always easy to empathize with Ahsoka. In that sense, very easy.
Now, before we hear your voicemails, we do have a continuity corner for both of these episodes from our own Nathan P. Butler.
Well, folks, our last official continuity corner of the Clone Wars' third season is, fortunately, bereft of any continuity nukes, as we might have called them. It is, however, a doozy in terms of new characters and references, especially since we do have two episodes here. So let's hit the episodes in order. For Padawan Lost, we were introduced to several new younglings, or at least several new characters. They seem to mostly be young, with three being our primary new protagonists for the episode. The oddballs, mostly appearing in the scene in which Ahsoka is dropped onto Waska, are the Snivian Matt Cole, based on the design of Snaggletooth, the Selkath Morgo, yes, the species that was also used in this series for the character Chata Hayoki, that was intriguing because it went back to the Knights of the Old Republic video games, a Torellian Jango jumper named Lika, the same species as Lightsaber Lost Cassie Cryer, a Sakaian named Vadu, and a hunter named Simna. The three we spend the most time with here, of course, as discussed, were Khalifa, Omer, and Jinx. Khalifa, a Corellian human, and Omer, a Saurian, both share name origins that dip back into Islamic culture. Jinx, meanwhile, is, well, just Jinx, and probably not named after the G.I. Joe ninja, though that would have made my day. Jinx, of course, is a Twi'lek, or as EU fans like to call them, Twi'leks. Khalifa is played by Gwendolyn Yao, though she sounds a lot like Cat Tabor. Yao has played Cato Parasiti in Holocron Heist, Pepe Bo in Blue Shadow Virus, and Kalita Shoals Kaminoan Nala Se, who appeared, though not always speaking, in Shadow of Malevolence, Brain Invaders, and Senate Murders. She also played the Betty Bot video jockey in Rookies. Omer is played by Sunil Malhotra, a new face to the saga, while Jinx is played by Cam Clark, who played numerous characters, though mostly only small roles, in Knights of the Old Republic, Jedi Academy, the video game, not the novel trilogy or the comic miniseries, of course, and Galen Azzamine, older brother of Ace Azzamine in the X-Wing Alliance video game. He was also, interestingly, Captain Janix Bouch in the groundbreaking fan film Troops, the creator of which, Kevin Rubio, also made the jump into official writing in the wake of the parody's success. We also get a new tactical droid, TZ-33. We'll come back to the Trandoshans. Felucia returns on the small screen here, owing its creation as it does to Lucas himself with Revenge of the Sith. The planet has previously appeared in Holocron Heist and Bounty Hunters, the latter of which also introduced Sugi, Serapas, and the new native Felucian farmers, all three of which returned by the end of this two-parter. The Wolf Pack also returns here, including four troopers that we've seen before. Wolf, of course, appeared with his eye intact in Rising Malevolence, then returned with one eye for Holocron Heist, Grievous Intrigue, and R2 Come Home in Season 2, along with Citadel Rescue a few weeks ago. Sinker previously appeared in Rising Malevolence, as did Boost, whereas Comet was previously seen in R2 Come Home and recently in Citadel Rescue. We have outside references here as well. The fortune cookie's A Dangerous Game is an intentional reference to Richard Connell's 1924 short story The Dangerous Game, which features a Russian big game hunter in the Caribbean, at least according to the episode guide on StarWars.com. Not something I've ever read. The hunting pods used by the Trandoshans are inspired by the Trouble Bubble flight pods, you know, those little white ones, from the original G.I. Joe cartoon and toy collection. Sochek, one of the Trandoshans, is based on the look of Walter Sobchak of The Big Lebowski, played by John Goodman. He bears the same amber goggles and cargo shorts, and he's a little rotund. The new little creatures that are seen in the episodes are Convorees, which then turn the tables on a Momong in the next episode. Moving on to Wookiee Hunt before we hit the Trandoshans, the obvious and aforementioned return here at the end is Sugi and Serapos, both of whom appeared along with her ship, unnamed at the time but now known as the Halo, in the episode Bounty Hunters. Sugi also appeared in Jabba's palace in Sphere of Influence. We also, as if it needed to be noted here, had our first appearances in the series of film and EU characters Chewbacca and Tarful, both Lucas creations for the films that the EU has expanded upon. And in the former case, killed, and in the latter case, put into slavery. Fuzzballs just can't catch a break. Both episodes are mostly set on Waska, W-A-S-S-K-A-H, which has been misspelled twice in recent memory. Once as Waska, W-A-S-S-K-H-A, with the last two letters reversed in the new episode guide on StarWars.com, and once as Ewaska, with an I in front of it, in Star Wars Insider, as referenced previously here on the show. Waska was first meant to be Dosha, the Trandoshan homeworld, which is also known as Trandosha and Haskor. The idea then shifted into making it a moon of that homeworld, although previously Dosha only had one moon, Akoshis. Now it has two, it seems. Still, though, that puts this moon in the Kashyyyk system, because that's where Dosha is, close enough for help to come quickly from Kashyyyk without having to heavily fudge travel times the way this series often does. Speaking of changes from previous scripts, we also learn in the episode guide that the hunting camp was originally on the ground, not a floating hunting lodge, and the original landing in Wookiee Hunt was to be in a canyon, not on a beach. And so we come to the Trandoshans themselves. There are 12 in these episodes, and each one is recognizable and named as an individual, unlike many new side characters in the series, such as the Wookiees in these episodes. The group leader is Garnak, easily recognizable by his several red horns, if that's the right term, spines, perhaps. His clothing is also unique amongst these Trandoshans in that his has a square section on his chest, reminiscent of Vader's chest panel, though it is missing in at least one scene. His son is Dar, the Beastmaster, who is recognizable as the one that's killed by Ahsoka by falling, though we might also note that he wears an open light vest with a brown shirt underneath over shorts. There are four fat Trandoshans here. Sochek, the Big Lebowski one, wears similar clothing to Dar. He's just fatter. Krix wears long pants and gear that forms two parallel lines like suspenders down his chest, with a connecting horizontal part going across his lower torso, and since I'm clueless what to call it, we'll just call that the U-shaped gear. Gilas, another fat Trandoshan, is recognizable by the two pauldrons, or something similar, that look like big shoulder pads on his upper chest and shoulders. Clutch, the final fat Trando, wears a dark top and pants, and the top is essentially one solid piece. The same styles were then used for the thin or regular Trandoshans. Smug is a thin version of Gilas, Lotaren is similar to Clutch, Ratter bears the U-shaped gear like Krix. To round it out, Lagon is as close to Han Solo attire as any of these Trandoshans get, while Rami and Goron both wear bandoliers from shoulder to opposite side of the torso, similar to Chewbacca. And the easiest way to tell them apart is that Rami has shoulder pads or pauldrons, while Goron doesn't. Got all that? Yeah, I didn't think so. I'll give you an easier way to tell them apart in a moment. To make it more of a headache, though, yet I guess a blessing in that they at least gave them all names, we've also learned there are more references and namesakes within this group of Trandoshans. Gylos is named after the Godzilla monster, Rami is named for Banthatrax editor Mary Franklin, Smug is named after Smaug from The Hobbit, Goron is named for the Gorn in the original Star Trek episode Arena, and Lagon is named after the creature from the Black Lagoon. As for the voice actors amongst the Trandoshans, not all of them get voices. Sirius regular Matt Lanter voices both Radder and Clutch, while James Arnold Taylor, Obi-Wan, voices Lagon. Dee Bradley Baker voices both Sochek and Goron. Lo-Taren and Krix are voiced by Richard Green. Hugo Strange and Toyman from The Batman. Garnak is voiced by Zach Hanks, perhaps best known as Captain McMillan in Call of Duty Modern Warfare, amongst his many voice credits, most of which are small bit parts, it seems. Dar, or Young Dar, is voiced by Kevin Toms. Lance from Symbiotic Titan. Rami and Gilas go without voices, it would appear. And in my favorite casting of the season, Smug is voiced by none other than Jeff Anderson, best known as Randall Graves from Clerks. Bunch of savages on that moon. If we're trying to keep them all straight, here's an easier way if you're watching the episodes. Just check out a few scenes and the final battle. Garnak is the leader, and Dar is his son who dies by falling when fighting Ahsoka. Those are the two easiest ones. The two on the ship that was carrying Chewie are Clutch, the big one with a shotgun-style weapon, and Goron, who fights Omer and Jinx on top of the ship. Later, Smug is the sniper who gets captured and used to get to the landing pad, and Krix is the one who brings the pod to them by responding to Smug's call. That's six right there. When they first arrive at the floating base, our heroes encounter Lagon, who's thrown overboard, and Rami, who calls for help. The call is first heard by Gilas on the left, and Radder on the right, from our perspective. Then Lo-Taren, the thin one who also was the one who found Ahsoka on Felucia, is shown responding on the left in a second reaction shot to Remy's call for help, and he's accompanied by Sochek, another fat one, who's on the right side of that same shot, with Garnak in the middle as they approach the railing when shown from behind looking down. Rami is then thrown, with a pod, into Gilas and Radder. As Chewie then deals with Radder, Ahsoka and Jinx deal with Gilas. Then Omer flies in, shooting down at Lo-Taren and Sochek. After Garnak shoots down Omer, Gilas, Rami, and Radder hold our heroes at gunpoint, soon joined by Lo-Taren and Sochek, though blink and you'll miss them. The halo then arrives, and Garnak goes for the gun again. He's shown with his chest pack missing, it seems, in this particular shot, but his head design and his collar are unmistakable. Tarful then throws Rami overboard, then stomps Gilas and growls. Radder is fighting Chewie, but he's hit by Omer and tossed overboard by Chewie. Lo-Taren is then shot while in cover, and Sochek actually says his name, just before the pod that he was using as cover is moved by Omer, and Sochek himself is shot. See? There you go. All 12, and easy places to notice which is which. Simple, right? Yeah. Talk about a headache when researching this episode. Lots of pausing that drove the girlfriend nuts. As for the trophies aboard their floating hunting lodge, as the episode calls it, we see Wookiee and Wampa pelts, an Ithorian head, a Gungan head, yes! A Gran head, Skrilling head, Reek head, big ol' Rancor head, and Dragon Snake. What might be a Zillow Beast tooth, a mounted Gundark and Narglatch, and most interestingly for those looking for oddball items, the Crystal Skull from the fourth Indiana Jones film, and a Mandalorian Neo-Crusader helmet, which, like several other previously mentioned ties, harkens back to the Knights of the Old Republic video game. Again, we see a pattern of the Clone Wars team lifting frequently from LucasArts games more than the EU, or at least in unchanged references, which also includes a note in the episode guide that, yes, the shotgun-style weapon used to accidentally bring down the Trandoshan slave ship was based on one seen in the Republic Commando video game, in which Tarful also appears. That's kind of ironic, given that while the series lifts from that game, it almost single-handedly ended the novel series based on that game, by changing the Mandalorians to the point where Karen Travis felt she could no longer write in the Star Wars universe effectively. We might also mention that we get three presumably new Wookiees here, as Chewbacca's message brings four, one being the dreadlocked and helmeted Tarful. However, we're not given names from what I can tell for any of the three new Wookiees, each of which bears a V or X pattern of gear across their chests, and which could be described as a dark one, a light one with shoulder pads, and a light one without shoulder pads. We'll let the Wookipedians worry about names for those for now. And speaking of Wookiee names, one has to wonder if the quote about the Wookiee way is a reference back to 1979's Way of the Wookiee by Archie Goodwin, reprinted in the U.S. in Marvel Illustrated Book Star Wars No. 1 in 1981. How's that for an obscure note to end on? That should wrap up Continuity Corner both for this week and this season.
Now, we did get a few voicemails this week. Let's see what you guys thought of the episodes.
Hey, it's Fernando here. Just saw the new Star Wars Season 3 finale, and they did really good in this episode. I was really surprised at it. I loved how they made the Trandoshans, like, they had this really cool growl and their noises that they make, and every time they call for help, they had this really cool help call. They did a really good job in that, and their animation was fantastic. It was really good animation. They came so far from season 1 to the end of season 3. I kind of wish that they made Chewbacca's fur, like, move around more. Like, but, like, not like they did in this episode where Chewbacca's fur was just, like, standing still. It's kind of weird to see that. And I loved how each Padawan, after each battle, they looked more and more dirty instead of just looking clean, like in the previous series, but it was pretty cool to see them getting dirty after each battle. Makes them more realistic, like, makes them look like they had really tough time fighting. And each Padawan was brave. I liked all the Padawans, all the new Padawans that we saw there. Of course, I like Ahsoka. She's been in all the seasons. I'm not having a good time with words today. Anyway, great episodes. Great season, great show, and I can't wait for season 4 this fall. Bye.
The one thing about the Wookiees, I mean, I thought that about that with the fur as well, but it took a while to get the Obi-Wan and the beards and everything, and the hair or whatever. I guess the beards aren't moving around because beards wouldn't do that. But, I mean, hair is starting to move around more on just the regular characters. So if this is the first time they developed, and obviously it is, developed the Wookiee models, it's going to take some usage and some effort if they're recurring, ongoing characters for them to improve the models. And I'm guessing we're not going to see Wookiees enough for that really to play in. But otherwise, I thought they were animated fairly well. I didn't feel like that they were so stylized that they're like, you know, sometimes you can look at some characters and like, well, that's not really that character. I mean, personally, I don't think Yoda looks great in this style, but other characters, particularly the Wookiees turned out fine. And you know, Shaak Ti, to me, just looks as normal as you could, you know, animate her. Doesn't look stylized at all. I mean, the character already looks stylized. And I think the Wookiees kind of fall in the same way. I think they gave them a really good treatment in the show.
Hey, guys, this is Will, otherwise known as Venator1229 on the forums, calling about the most recent Clone Wars episode, the season finale of season 3. I just like to say it was very well done. Clone Wars is very well known for their season finales, I think, and them being really good. The action was good, animation was good, storyline excellent. I just want to talk about a few things. First of all, the part of Felucia I really liked just because of the tactics they used, and I thought that was really cool in the way Ahsoka was kidnapped. And then jumping further ahead, when Chewbacca arrives on the planet, I had no idea Ahsoka knows Wookiee, and I'm sure you guys will probably talk about that on the show or not, but whatever. And what I also really noticed a lot was the use of Republic Commando traits in it. Like, it was cool hearing, like, all the sound effects you hear in the game, like the shotgun sound effects and all the other things that can be related back to the game. I was not expecting to see Tarful in this. Like, when I saw him, like, I was really shocked, but, like, good shocked. Like, I was really happy to see him. In the end, I was not expecting the Wookiees to come with Tarful. Like, I was expecting, like, the Republic to just swoop in with, like, gunships and, like, Rex and ARC troopers, and Anakin would just come in and start, like, beating down the Trandoshans and stuff. Like, I thought that'd be kind of cooler, but it was still pretty neat seeing all the Wookiees and Chewbacca's friends. And then lastly, I thought the ending was also really good with, like, Anakin and Ahsoka talking with each other. And I was really certain that Ahsoka right there urged her later on that she'd be promoted to Jedi Knights, to seeing Yoda, like, kind of looking at Anakin and Ahsoka with kind of like a high opinion of them and stuff. Yeah, anyway, it was a really good episode, I thought, in conclusion. And I'll see you guys next fall. Have a good summer. Bye.
Thank you very much, Will. Yes, we do agree on a lot of those points. And don't worry, you don't have to wait until season 4 to hear from us again. We've got a season wrap-up next week. Then we have summer programming that'll be coming your way, which we'll announce next week as well.
Hi, this is Deb from up in Seattle again. So we just saw the last episode of season 3, Secrets Revealed. So what was the big secret that got revealed again? I mean, it had to be somewhere in this episode. It sure as heck hadn't been in any of the others earlier. So it had to be something in this last episode. Let me think here. What great secret did they actually reveal this time? Well, I guess it all boils down to this. Remember, kiddies, force choke, bad. But force smash with flying weird boxy air speeder, good. Thanks. Bye.
That's kind of what we got into a little bit earlier where, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity into the morality of this stuff. I mean, I guess it's supposed to be that it's your intent, not your action that does it. It's a very, isn't that, I don't want to get all theological here, but isn't that somewhat of a difference between different Christian denominations? Isn't that how Catholicism, at least I know at one point Catholicism talked about how the intention behind an action, even if the action is not carried out, still acts as a sin because it is that conscious choice made within yourself. I mean, I guess that's sort of what they're trying to get at, how there's an intention behind an action, and if an action is done with the best of intentions, it's okay. But still, I mean, it's in this case, I mean, you're in the heat of battle, you're in the heat of war. Morality becomes very gray in a situation like that. So yeah, I think we all kind of have that same when it comes to the morality of killing versus going to the dark side here.
Yes, and as far as what the secret revealed in these two episodes was,
Ahsoka can speak Treewook. Trandoshans sound like velociraptors. Sugi and Serapos are in fact still around. Yoda now approves of the relationship between Anakin and Ahsoka. And Trandoshans name their kids after the Beastmaster.
But no, Nathan, you're right. I mean, I don't think it's a denomination thing. I mean, you know, Christ taught that in the New Testament about, you know, if you even look upon, this is just an example, if you even look upon someone with lust, you are guilty of adultery because the sin is in your heart. Now, it's a different, you know, yet an additional sin to go ahead and execute, you know, the lustful feelings there. But yeah, it's, you know, really what's in your heart. And if the Jedi have a parallel to that, to say the action itself versus the action that'll take you to the dark side, it's all with the intent and the motivation. If you're killing them because I just want to see this guy suffer and die, that's different. And we talked this earlier, I understand, but that's different than saying, hey, I gotta just take out this enemy for the survival of the group. She clearly had the revenge in her eyes when she was doing what she was doing. So yeah, I get it. I get that.
I'm concerned about if they do go that route where it's all about your intentions, you reach a point where, given the fact that Anakin is trying to protect Padme in Revenge of the Sith, when he does some of the things that he does, granted, it's selfish in a sense because he cares about her and it's not the greater good of everyone, but he is still trying to help someone else and save her life in the actions that he takes that wind up turning him into Vader. It's kind of a slippery slope, not necessarily morality-wise, but in terms of the exploration of morality, if they're really going to try to go that route within Lucas's preferred form of Star Wars here. I'm curious to see whether or not they elaborate on that at all in the future. Probably not, but it'd be interesting to hear Lucas's thinking on that.
Hi, everyone. It's Robert Darth Akari calling in with my thoughts on the final two episodes of Clone Wars this season, that one lost in Wookiee Hunt. Well, I mean, I don't know if there's anything else you can possibly say about how impressive the visuals are getting on this show. I mean, between, you know, the fungus light up thing from Felucia to, I can't think of the name of the other planet that they went to, but just the sheer depth of detail on the plant life and the animal life. It's obvious that they've learned how to make realistic-looking insects in this episode, so we no longer have to deal with the giant bugs, but we have, like, actual little spiders and ants and things on stuff. And they're not just on Felucia, but on the other planet as well. Story-wise, I thought it was a very solid couple of episodes. I mean, not quite as suspenseful as, say, the Witches of the Mist, you know, Savage Opress arc had been, but still very impressive. I know I posted on the forums, I was kind of wondering what folks are thinking about the fact that we've had two episodes in a row where Ahsoka has been the present at the death of another character. So I'm kind of wondering if that's going to be playing out in the long run into her development, is the fact that, you know, she was there for Even Peele, and then, you know, again, in this episode with the other Padawan when she died. Also, another thing I was thinking about, speaking of Ahsoka, is her actual body count is actually starting to go up here. I mean, I'm trying to think, but I think she's actually killed more characters than Anakin has killed characters in the Clone Wars, you know, cartoon thus far. I mean, I know he's, you know, as far as battle droids, you know, there's one thing, but she's actually, you know, starting to rack up a decent number of actual, you know, I am personally responsible for killing a living being total here. So, I mean, heck, she killed two Trandoshans herself in this arc. Chewie was good. I mean, I enjoyed him. He looked like Chewie. He sounded like Chewie, obviously. His mannerisms were just about right. I mean, at first it kind of bothered me that they didn't make him more heroic, but, you know, like over-the-top heroic. But then again, that kind of fits with his character. I mean, he did have those kind of maybe not over-the-top moments, even in A New Hope, where, you know, he was afraid to go down the garbage chute and things like that. A little disappointed we didn't see him rip or any of the Wookiees rip anybody's arms off, but I guess, you know, that's something that probably wouldn't get away with on American television. Although there was a satisfying crunch noise when he stopped that Trandoshan from stabbing the Padawan early on after his introduction. One other thing that I was rather happy to see, and was the big surprise for me actually for this episode, was the return of Sugi and her crew with when they came to the rescue with the rest of the Wookiees at the end of the episode. Thought that was kind of a cool added little touch to see some recurring characters. And, you know, nothing much, just a little cameo appearance there, but it was nice to see them again. And also, seeing as the fact the last time we saw them, it was on Felucia, it kind of makes sense, I guess, is sort of their stomping ground that they kind of work out of. So, as far as the prequel, preview for the upcoming fourth season, found a couple things that were sort of interesting in that. You know, first of all, the fact that it looks like we're going to be going over a couple of things that either appeared in the Tartakovsky series or in the comics, because we're going to see Grievous obviously fighting Gungan, so possibly we may reference the whole story arc that we had with the bioweapon that was in the comics for the Clone Wars that took place, you know, a few years back. And also, it looks like we're going to get our battle on Mon Cal, which is kind of cool to see. So, also, another thing I noticed is it looks like Padme's dusting off her old clothes and hairstyles, because she, in that one scene, it looked like she was wearing her outfit and hairstyle from episode one when she was talking to Dooku there via hologram. So, but, obviously, it's going to be a pretty cool season coming up. It's going to be tough waiting through the summer, but I'll be looking forward to seeing what you guys do as your summer series. Have a good one, everyone. Bye.
I find it interesting. Robert brings up a good point. Ahsoka, in the last few episodes, is getting to be like that cat that was in the news a while back in a nursing home, and they kind of watch it, and when it goes into a room and settles on somebody's lap, that means they're about to die. So now Ahsoka is going to be the one. We watch her, whoever she's paired up with, is probably not going to survive. Yeah, we're going to talk about the previews a whole bunch in the coming weekend. We'll cover, well, both the previews that have been released so far, and if anything else creeps up, then we'll talk about that too.
Hey, this is Glenn calling in about the Clone Wars episode, Lost Padawan. Haven't actually managed to watch the finale yet, but hopefully I won't say anything that's totally obliterated by that. Really enjoyed the last Padawan episode. Liked how we sort of see, you know, Ahsoka sort of showing leadership over other Jedi and sort of leadership being on her own. And we really got a good feel for, you know, what Trandoshans are like. But it sort of made me get the feeling of why this is, quote, a, quote, kids show. It's because for a kids show, for a kid, this is like a really great, exciting, fun episode. It's using Ahsoka, you know, fighting and you know, all these, you know, cool little aliens and stuff like that. But for me, as an adult, the thing that's sort of lacking in this episode is this is a great episode to sort of see what, well, to learn something about being a Zagruta. Because, you know, she's, you know, these other Jedi younglings are there, but, you know, she's a Zagruta, and I'm not quite exactly sure, but I think they're sort of more of a predator-type species. So, you know, will that come into play? I mean, I don't, you know, you'd learn more about that. And I think the thing that we really have seen throughout these episodes is that basically everybody is really a human that sort of is dressed up in an alien costume. And, you know, we're sort of seeing that. And I think, and that's an adult perspective. And, you know, we got to learn about Trandoshans in this episode, but we don't really learn about the Grutas. And hopefully maybe that'll happen in the second half, but we'll probably just learn more about Wookiees. So, that's my thoughts. And, I'll probably call in with my, thoughts on the second episode once I see it when I get home. But probably won't make it fun to the show. Bye.
Now, it's true, though. Togruta are carnivorous. You know, Togruta are presented that way, at least within the expanded universe. But we don't know how much of that really comes from anything that Lucas actually intended for the characters and such. I mean, we also have things coming in from the EU, like the fact that, well, Togruta generally don't wear shoes. But Ahsoka has been wearing boots or something similar pretty much throughout the entire series. I'm not sure how much we can really base our interpretation of what we should be expecting from the Clone Wars with Togruta on what the EU has established for them.
I disagree with Glenn. I don't feel that this episode was very kiddified. I feel quite the opposite, actually. I mean, we saw, as I mentioned earlier, we saw a young person get killed in a rather brutal way. I mean, we've seen aliens and droids run through and cut in half, but to see a blaster bolt go through a human character, because she's supposed to be a human from Corellia. So, I mean, this is a flat-out human child being killed, not an alien with a rubber mask or whatever. So that's somewhat different. That's very different.
This is Glenn calling back in about Wookiee Hunt. And I really have to say, I think this is the best episode that they've done of the Clone Wars. I mean, they really actually had a pretty tight story, you know, unlike I think the first episode, which was kind of like, and you can't manage to use a tracking device and where's your air support and there's some ship left or whatever. But a pretty tight story, you know, stranded and they good, you know, scheme and it worked. And I think, you know, I didn't really quite notice any plot holes. And the one thing that I was really excited, it was something that sort of some people sort of predicted or whatever, that there'd be some big scene with like Yoda and the Wookiees. And I kind of sort of was going to Yoda even, I was hoping Yoda wouldn't even show up in the episode. But he didn't interact with the Wookiees because, you know, in episode 3, Yoda talks about, oh, good, you know, good relationship with the Wookiees have I or whatever his backwards talk is. And, you know, he's like 900 years old. So, and the Wookiees are also, I don't know if they're as long-lived as species, but they're pretty old too, 200, 300 years old. So, I mean, he could have done something 100 years ago, 50 years, I mean, long, I mean, he could have done something almost just after the, you know, the old, I mean, 500 years ago. I mean, that wasn't really kept up relationships, but, you know, he should have done something a long time ago. He shouldn't have anything noteworthy to say that anybody in the council doesn't already know. If it's something, you know, something happened a year ago in the Clone War, everybody in the council knows that. He doesn't need to point this out that he has this relationship. If he did something 25, 40, 50 years ago, then he needs to point this out, hey, I've dealt with the Wookiees before, I'm going to go out there and help them. So I'm glad that there wasn't something that sort of messed up my thinking in that regard in this episode. But having seen all these Wookiees, all these Trandoshans, the nice Trandoshan War, glad to see that brought into the Clone Wars and sort of, I don't know, canonized or whatever you want to call it. And I think it was just very tight, good fighting. I had to say good use of violence, but good use of violence. I mean, I think it's really great. I mean, really the only sort of complaint about this episode being, like I said, the best episode, I mean, the animation is just fantastic. You see, like, if you're watching that on Cartoon Network, you see all these previews for these other shows, and you're like, they all look like junk comparatively. I mean, it's not even close. And the storytelling is good. The only problem I really would have with this episode is this didn't need to be, like, you know, part of Star Wars, the Clone Wars. I mean, it could have been, you know, any time. You know, there's no Clone Wars about this episode for the most part. And that's really the only thing that's sort of missing. I'd like to see an episode sort of like this that is part of the lore. You know, they're ingrained on the Wookiee planet and are on this mission. And so, I mean, honestly, there's a mission at the very beginning of Padawan Lost, which was kind of cute. But, I mean, I like to see something more going back to that or whatever. And, of course, the end when Tsuji, I think that's the Bionator's name, comes in, at least we have great to see, you know, the reuse and that character being brought back. Don't quite know why she was, you know, the Wookiee planet is quote close to where they are. Why they need to have some bounty hunter needs to come provide transport, but I'll ignore that. But I just thought it was great, and I hope you guys did too. And look forward to hearing your opinion, and I will be calling back for my year in review talk. Bye.
I disagree with Glenn that this episode could have taken place at any time because, well, post Revenge of the Sith, there wouldn't be any Padawans to be kidnapped, and pre the Clone Wars, they weren't out running training missions and all over the galaxy in the middle of a war. I mean, they had training missions, but they probably did them all in academies, not necessarily out gallivanting around. So the chaos that a group of Padawans could disappear and be kind of written off as, well, casualties of war wouldn't have occurred before the Clone Wars. So as far as when this occurred, I think this is the perfect time for these events of both these episodes to have taken place, is within the chaos that is the Clone Wars.
On the same note, I mean, you need the Clone Wars era to have these particular characters as well. I mean, if you look at this in the broader sense as being about Ahsoka sort of proving herself to be a fulfillment of Anakin's teachings and a success for him, and taking that last little scene with Yoda as essentially a coda, no rhyming intended, going back to the film, the Clone Wars film. The idea that now he sort of approves of the relationship, it's that he approves of how the training is going, then you have to have a situation in which these characters can be present. It can't just be any Jedi. We need this to be Anakin and somebody he has trained. Well, he's not a knight until a little bit after Attack of the Clones, and he's not going... And we know he doesn't have a Padawan by the time we reach Revenge of the Sith. So if you're going to have someone there in that position, it pretty much has to be, if this was meant to be Anakin character development along with Ahsoka. I think generally what he was saying, though, was that it could just be any time period. There's a lot of Star Wars stories that are like that, especially in the short stories, things like in the Adventure Journal and in Gamer, a lot of the RPG scenarios especially, where there's stories that could have taken place just about anywhere. There's no real indication this must be in here. If it had not been for the fact that Anakin is the master, or if it had not been for the fact that the opening was a Clone Wars battle, then yeah, this could have been just about any time, at least within the life cycle of Yoda, Chewbacca, and so forth. Speaking of the whole life cycle thing, though, I have to say I'm not totally convinced that it would have just made perfect sense for Yoda to have had this positive relationship with the Wookiees hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Granted, at some point, and we don't know exactly when, he was the Jedi Watchman for that area. At some point, presumably before he gets on the Jedi Council. But if you think about real-life diplomacy, things change drastically very quickly. I mean, we in Japan, on the same side in World War I, enemies, mortal enemies, dropping atomic bombs on them after Pearl Harbor a few years before that, where they came after us, that changes dramatically between World War I and World War II. Then we become big-time allies. Or you take the situation of something like Russia. We are on the side of Russia going into World War I. They have a revolution. Things change. We are allies of convenience going into World War II. Afterwards, it's the Cold War. And eventually you wind up in a situation where we are supposed allies, sort of, but now still rivals in a sense because of politics going into, say, the Middle East. Things change rapidly enough, so it seemed to make more sense that the events he's referring to in Revenge of the Sith were much more recent. Now, why would he have to announce that? Well, half the time these characters are announcing all kinds of stuff they don't really need to for the audience's benefit. But if you think about it, that still sort of makes sense, because even within any administration, you have those who are better fits to go talk to representatives of particular countries. And if you think of Star Wars as, in a sense, all these different planets as essentially different nations, in a sense, nation in the sense of collective of similar people, or nation states even, then that's sort of what we have here. Yoda saying, you know, if anybody's going to go deal with the Wookiees, I've had the best relations with them. I'm the natural choice to go. And maybe, yeah, they would have already known that. But he says it in a way of saying, I volunteer. Don't worry. I'll go ahead and take on that mission. It's not him saying, hey, guys, remember, I have good relations with the Wookiees. Pick me, pick me, pick me. He's saying, I'll go. I got the good relations. It only makes sense. No worries. I got it covered. So it could have very easily been recent. And I don't think it undermines his dialogue in Revenge of the Sith necessarily at all.
All right. We want to thank everybody for joining us for our discussion of Padawan Lost and Wookiee Hunt, and also for joining us for all of Season 3. It's been a very interesting season. We've been kind of back and forth both sides of the spectrum as far as loving it and hating it. But we will discuss all of those points in detail in a week on our Season 3 wrap-up show. So join us next week. Be sure to leave us a voicemail letting us know what were the highs and lows for you for the past season. And we will see everyone next week. Thank you, Nathan, Jerry, and Barrett for joining me. And we'll see you all next week.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
All right, Rockstar.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Barrent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all of the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademark, Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a production of Venganza Media Incorporated, copyright 2011, all rights reserved.
Everybody must think it's fun to go hunt Gungan, so they must be considered really low on the sentient pyramid.
Well, I guess it's not that far out. I mean, people here, we hunt quail. You know, although you don't see very many quail stuffed and mounted, but I'm sure Gungan. There's someone out there.
Gungan, the Star Wars quail.
The Star Wars quail, right?
And they can't spell potato either.
Yes.
Yeah. Misa been shot.
Well, and Jinx does say that they've been there more cycles than they can count or than they can remember.
So. Yeah, but what's a cycle? Is that a month? Is that a year? Is that, well, I mean,
it's 28 days.
Wow.
Yes, my wife just asked, is Jen on call? So, no.
This is why we need Jen on calls like this, so she can tame us. The joke would never have come out of Dan's mouth if Jen had been on the call. And I'm shocked that of all of us, Baron's the one who's just kind of silent there going, mm-hmm.
Do we have anything else, or are we okay with going into continuity corner now?
Did you just call me the guy in the class who's asking the teachers questions that's not going to be on the test?
Yes,
is that
I
what
did.
You just called me?
That's pretty much where I just went there. You're that guy, Barrett. Congratulations.